Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Dark Hustle. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast and subscribing and following us. It's super cool. You guys are the best. Also, if you are not a member of our Patreon, what are you doing? Go check it out. It's got multiple levels to choose from, and we have early access over there for all of our episodes and a bunch of other stuff. So go check us out on Patreon.
Hey, is this Miss Kimball?
It sure is.
Did I say it right?
You did.
I'm so sorry for my delay. I actually just had this little thing come up literally like at 4:58, and I was like, oh my God, this lady's going to hate me.
That's all right.
First of all, thank you so much for talking to this random person on Facebook.
You're so fun.
You own Spooks Gotta Wit.
Correct.
How did this whole come about? Like, how did it all come about for you to have this amazing animal? How did you end up with him?
Well, actually, I never intended to have a stallion. It was a complete accident.
And oh, wow.
The question of how I ended up with him is equally mystifying to me. I was at a horse show in Las Vegas, and I was not a Western horse person. I actually trained English horses my whole life. So I had a series of surgeries to repair some damage from a motorcycle wreck that I was in. And at the time, I ended up meeting some trainers to help me with the horses I did have, and they were reining trainers. So I stepped into it completely backwards and fell into it. And then I'm at this show in Las Vegas, and everybody's talking about this big event, the Futurity, and I didn't even know what it was, never had been to it. And they said, well, your trainer can ride 3 horses. And I thought, well, I'm going to get 3. It sounded interesting, so how fun would that be? And then I set out, I guess, to go find some, and they are not easy to find, obviously. I didn't know anything right about it at the time, so I just assumed I could get some. And, well, anyway, I just happened to have an opportunity to fly to Texas with my trainer, and he was available, and that's pretty much how it happened. It was really unintentional, and I was looking for a mare at the time, so never planned to have a boy horse. But then I ended up with him, and he was 2 years old at the time I bought him, and went through the training process. And, of course, you know, as the story goes, he won the Futurity, which was crazy because didn't even know what it was. Oh, my gosh. It's been an incredible journey. Anyway, now he's an amazing, amazing horse, but it's really just because he's truly a special animal. I mean, he's amazing. He just is. He is.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy because, like, those extraordinary situations or things in your life always seem to come out of, like, nowhere. It's like like what you just said, unintentional. And, you know, the fact that the whole thing was unintentional for you just speaks volumes that it was going to be something successful. Now, let me back up to where you grew up. English, is that what you said, just general English?
Yes, I trained jumping horses for 30 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And well, that was a big change.
It was a huge change, still is. I never was successful actually showing reining horses. I've had a lot of very, very nice horses in my life, and I've had some opportunity to ride some pretty, you know, fancy jumping horses, fancy reining horses, but I just, reining Western is just not my thing. So, you know, I'm not a young chicken, so I started, when I bought him, I was in my mid-40s, so most of the people that are in this industry that are successful have started very young.
Yeah.
Specifically in Western, right? It's not easy to make the switch. So, you know, having ridden English my whole entire life, it was something new, and it's hard to do. It's people that think raining's easy have never tried it. but I really enjoy watching professional riders ride my horses, so I've been more successful just having horses with open riders at all different levels. And also, I've been breeding horses long before I had him, just, you know, mares that I had, and so I enjoy raising them. And that's pretty much the trajectory of how it went. I do ranch riding, so that is much closer in nature to the English, in that the gates are forward and it's just more, it's, I was very successful doing it that when I was riding in the ranch riding. And so I ride intermittently because I have a lot of other things I have to do, but you know, I enjoyed showing in the ranch riding and still managing my stud. So it's just a lot of work.
Well, you just touched on something, like people think riding reiners is easy. I look at it and I think it's probably one of the harder disciplines to even attempt to do, because, you know, we've had a couple of reining people on the podcast, and they've all kind of said the same thing. Like, it's not a walk in the park. Not to make any of the others lighter, like, they're just as hard. You have to be just as talented. But reining, like, it's not easy. It's very hard to do. I admire it. I always thought it was cool, because I just look at it and like, how do they even do that?
Well, one of the difficulties of putting together a really, you know, clean and beautiful and correct reining pattern, there's a lot of elements to the pattern. So unlike jumping, there's obviously things that, you know, you have to do correctly there as well, but you're on pace and you're going one direction and you're jumping the fences in a certain order, so you have a pattern. It's nothing like having to deal with speed changes and direction changes and maneuver changes and stopping and slowing and speeding up, and all the while having your horse look happy, be forward, be under control without the impression of the rider, you know, doing a lot. And to do all that, it's pretty spectacular. So dressage is also, dressage would be the equivalent in English of reining, and dressage is also very difficult. It is a lot of work. It takes a long, long time to train a dressage horse to get to the level that, you know, some of the reining horses get to at a much younger age. But the complexity, dressage is a lot, it's just a lot different. It's more work. It's harder.
Right.
But they would be considered pretty equivalent. I was never super successful because I would skip a lot of my dressage lessons, but, but, you know, having done it, it's very similar. You have to execute the same types of maneuvers, and you have to, you know, it's the same thing. And it's at a high level, it's amazing to watch and very difficult to execute. But the reining, I think it comes with, you know, having to do a lot of different things at speed, and also to be able to show your horse willingly guided and make it look effortless. That's why these people are so amazing that can do it. Anyone that can do a reining pattern, they get incredible appreciation from me. I think it's hard.
I agree 110%. Now, as far as the actual, because you know, Wiz, do you call him Wiz for short? What do you call him for short?
No, I call him Baby.
Baby. Well, so does he still stands to the public, right? Obviously.
Absolutely, yeah.
What part of that process do you have your hands in or don't have hands? Because, you know, I have some people kind of just let somebody else handle it and take care of it, and then some people are just all completely hands-on.
So I set the criteria for his breeding program, but I don't actually get involved in the actual process of dealing with the customers, getting the mares bred, all that kind of thing. But I am very involved in what gets bred to him, how many get bred to him, and that kind of thing. He has certain genetics, which I'm very involved in educating people on his genetics and other genetics in the horse industry. And I think it's critically important that people understand what constitutes a good mating and what doesn't. Not everybody wants to be educated, but it's my stallion, and I don't want to. I want to have the best offspring on his record, and I don't want to have compromised right. individuals. So that part of it, I'm extremely involved. Also, I'm his mommy, and so, you know, when it comes to making decisions about him, you know, everything goes through me. But his stallion managers, he's had the best care. He's in amazing condition for a stallion that is his age. He went to the Run for Million at 17 years old, still marking a 221, and he hadn't been ridden in 10 years, and I didn't tell anybody, and he only had 4 weeks to get ready. So that in and of itself was an accomplishment and a feat that, you know, I think few other horses could actually do that. In our industry, it would be nice if more horses could. Yes. Yeah, for him, it really does. He came out of there so happy, and he looked like he could have just gone in and done it again. I mean, and he's the happiest horse ever. He's got a great personality, and he passes all the best traits that he has on to his little babies, and that's been the fun part now for me is, you know, watching the people showing them, raising the offsprings. That's been the best.
Well, right. I mean, I think a lot of people, most people like who don't, non-horse people, when they look on from the outside looking in, you know, they don't understand kind of the dollar amount and the value that goes into horses for certain disciplines and certain things that you do, whether you're just trail riding or you're all the way up like what he's doing, you know, futurity champions over and over and over. It would be the same concept as if, you know, you can't exactly go drag racing with a Toyota.
Well, and it's also, you know, a lot of it is just that he has had exceptional care, and he's had everything that he needed. I did not overshow him. So when he was going to go compete in France at the World Equestrian Games, I gave him an entire year to year off completely from showing.
Wait, whoa. Did you just say France?
Yeah, he showed at the World Equestrian Games in France in 2014. He won 2 gold medals. He won the team individual gold, and he won the individual gold and the team gold. He was the high score on the team. So he did that.
How cool is that?
Yeah, and he hadn't been ridden since then. So that was his last time that he showed. And here I pulled him out of retirement because, I don't know, I thought it would be a fun thing to do. He's healthy. Right. I thought it'd be great to show the world that not all reiners are done at such a young age, which our industry gets a lot of flack for that. And he went in there, and he really, if he had had more time to get ready, he could have done maybe, you know, more than he did. He didn't need to. Like, that wasn't the purpose of going. The purpose of going was just to show everybody, wow, you know, I don't want him the rest of his life just to be solely about breeding. He's happy. He plays in turnout. He's doing all these fun things, and I wanted to give him a chance to, for people that were breeding to him that had never seen him show, it was a great opportunity to put him back out there and let people see that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that was a great idea. Now, back to France, because it just blew my mind. I think that's so cool that, I don't think a lot of people know that reining, just like cutting, is done outside of the United States. Like, they have, like, affiliates in other countries that do this stuff hardcore. And it's really cool that you just said France. Did you get to go with him, or did you just send him by himself? So you got to get, holy cow. So what is one of the biggest differences between how, let's say they conduct, how they handle horses, I guess, per se, versus the United States? Are there any differences that you noticed or remember?
So at that particular show, it's the equivalent of the Olympics. So just like our athletes, you know, the horses are pretty much sequestered. They have time slots for warming up. It's monitored probably like a prison. I mean, literally, you can't just have access to them. They're monitoring them to make sure that nobody's harming them, giving them drugs, you know, all that. I mean, it was the strictest competition. It's FEI. And it has every discipline there. So it was basically the Olympics. So you had every single thing that you could possibly have going on. It was amazing. And it was really, really different. So then that's not a typical European horse show. The horses are just as big all over the world as they are here. The shows aren't as big as they are here, but it's all the same in every country. Every country, you know, they've all got something going on. So I just got back from Italy. I went to the European Derby.
Oh, cool.
The care is very different in Europe. So much more how my English, you know, how we take care of the horses in the English world, much more how they take care of them in Europe. And, you know, people are not drugging horses. It's just managed differently. It's because that's just the way that, you know, care for animals is much more strict overseas than it is in the U.S. Just in general. I mean, yes. And so it's quite exciting to go there. I'm going actually in November to the Italian Futurity, and I'm super excited about that. So that's probably my second biggest market is in Italy, and the horses there, the trainers, a lot of our best trainers came from Italy, and they just do a great job. And all the trainers come from all over Europe to go show there because it's a big event, just like ours. Probably not as big as ours, but it is,
right?
You know, same thing. So,
well, I think I actually had a guy talk about this. He put it in perspective for me. Western discipline, or the Western style, probably a better word, of riding, was not the first way of riding when it comes to the markets overseas. English is the basis of, like, markets overseas, and this guy was particularly from Europe, and so, or from England, and he said, you know, it's not necessarily frowned upon, but, like, their, you know, house, per se, way of riding is English, and it's not Western. And so, you know, it's a lot different. Whereas over here in the United States, I feel like maybe Western got its start here. And so it's a little more custom to be a way of riding versus overseas. So it makes sense for what you're saying, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that absolutely that's the case. I mean, you know, you look at Queen Elizabeth and, you know, she rode jumping horses. I think that, you know, the warm bloods dressage is huge in Europe versus here. So it's bigger there. And it's kind of almost the opposite. So where the most important and prized stallions are in Europe, they don't import them. They don't export them here. And we tend to keep, you know, more of our prized top stock here, and we sell the offsprings over there. So, but it's getting more balanced. All the time. And in the U.S., we just have a higher population of equestrians. So there's more horse sports in general. Racing's big here, but it's also big in other countries too. Australia, it's big in England. So pretty much, you know, I think it's starting to overall across the globe sort of kind of equivalent. Several countries, like lots of countries that didn't really have a lot of horse sports going on in any direction, Japan and those countries are starting to now get, you know, much bigger memberships, and they're growing quite fast.
I think it's really cool. You just made me think about something else I was going to ask you about. What is your opinion on Yellowstone and the industry? Because obviously you were in this, doing this long before the show come about. What is your take on it? Did you see it make a massive impact? Are you glad to see it go? Wish it would come back?
I have never watched an episode of Yellowstone. I'm going to be brutally honest in that I have a very hard time watching anything that has horses in it related to Hollywood. So it doesn't matter what movie it is. I probably haven't seen it. I never saw Hidalgo or any of those things. I grew up watching Fury. Probably that's when I was like, you know, 7 or 8 years old. That's pretty much how I decided that, you know, I had to be a horse girl when I was 8 years old. But, you know, other than that, so I really don't have an opinion on Yellowstone. Anything that introduces people or gets them excited about something can't really be bad. Right. But as for, you know, it's not really a really great way to promote a sport, for instance, through that show, because I've never seen the show, but as far as I understand, you know, they might have a clip here and there of raining, but it's not about raining. It's not a show about raining, like, you know what I mean? And so it's more about, okay, well, there's a ranch involved and guns. So pretty much I live in Texas and that's my daily life. Yeah.
Well, I've never watched it either. I just know, you know, a lot of people could feel a height in the industry because of it. Like, you know, before it wasn't necessarily, I don't want to say it wasn't cool because it was still cool, but it wasn't as publicized as much until Yellowstone come around to that. Yellowstone just kind of actually just put a light on horses in general, like in general. And, you know, some people feel like it helped the industry. It definitely helped prices and things of that nature. So I didn't know if you felt that.
Yeah, I disagree. I think if anything else, you could maybe credit Taylor Sheridan more for being involved in our industry and helping that way, not necessarily the show itself. Now, right. a lot of the top trainers were able to get visibility and whatever. They might personally feel that it helped them. I don't think it did really anything for the horse prices. I haven't noticed any change in my and the value of my horses based on that TV show. No one's come here and said, hey, you know, I watched Yellowstone. I want to have a reining horse. Let me come here and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a baby horse. I mean, it happens. People come here and buy horses. It's just, I don't see the connection because I didn't watch it. But I Right. know that new trainers were able to get involved. I think Taylor very much involved in our in reining, and he loves it, and he's becoming a bigger player. So for his part of it, that probably helped more. Now, I'm sure the show did much for him, but I don't know that it, you know, I mean, I don't know that I could credit that way personally, but that doesn't mean it's not true. It might be true for others, but I'm also not a trainer, right? So, I mean,
right. I think some people, I think it did have an effect on the industry a little bit, for sure. It made people see the lifestyle and wanted to have something to do with it. But like you said, that's a good thing. Any publicity is a good thing, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I really think that if it introduces people to horses, it doesn't matter if it introduces them to reining, to cutting, to cow horses, or to just be a rancher, or to maybe just have one, or to go out and ride. So
right.
I feel like if it introduces people to our lifestyle of being a horse person, then that's cool. That's pretty much what the show, you know, but there's other shows, right? There's lots of Westerns, and every time like a good show of any kind, or even shows about the natural horsemanship that Robert Redford was in, I don't remember the name of it, but there's, you know, those shows.
I remember that one.
Yes. Anytime there's shows that show the gentle side and the love that horses can provide you and the lifestyle that you can live. And for people that can afford it, they're going to get into it. I guarantee you probably 90% of the population watching Yellowstone cannot still figure out how to either buy a horse, to where to put one, or whether or not they can afford one. I mean, if you're living in New York City, and no matter how much you really want one, you might go on a trip to Montana and ride one, but you're just never going to really actually own one. So I just
right.
still have, I have a real problem just making the connection between that show and improvement in our industry. Again, I do more credit Taylor Sheridan because he's involved in our industry. He's created some pretty valuable and important events for our industry, and he promotes the reining industry. So through his own personal endeavors of wanting to be excellent in the show pen and to have nice horses and to have a nice ranch, I think he's done that job more than the show.
Yeah, I can see where you're saying with that, because, you know, without putting a light on it, nobody would know.
Exactly. And, you know, and he's really involved. So, I mean, you know, to his credit, you know, it's a passion, I think, for him. So it was a personal thing he created. People love the show. I mean, I don't watch it, but that doesn't mean it's not good. I mean, I just don't watch a lot of TV, and I just don't watch I don't watch any horse shows. I really normally can't. But I think that he's done a pretty good job of marketing the possibilities of what can be. And unfortunately, you know, reining, when you keep saying that it's an elite thing, that's almost not good for us, right? Because it makes it less accessible to just, you know, the masses and people that would otherwise be able to get involved. It's very, very expensive. But so is cow horse, so is cutting. And some of those are even more expensive because you have extra, you know, fees associated with having cows and all that kind of thing. So,
it generally costs more to own and show a reiner. It just is what it is. Like it's just black and white. It costs more to own a reiner and show a reiner than it does, you know, if you just go to a local fun show or a 4-H show or something of that matter. I don't think any one is better than the other. I think they're all the same. I have respect for all of them, but it does cost more to even own a reiner, show a reiner, have them trained, because I feel because the discipline is just harder. I mean, you know, we already talked about that. It's a harder discipline to do, just like dressage. Dressage is, like what you just said, the reining of the English world. It costs more to do it. It costs more to train it. Those warm bloods are, some of them are more expensive than reiners. So, you know, it just is what it is. But back to, before I forget, I was going to ask you, what do you foresee for his future? Because he's, what, 17 now? What do you see, you know, for him within the next 3, 5, 10 years? Do you plan on retiring him anytime soon, or you're going to try to?
Well, the way our industry works is that basically, you know, he's at a breeding farm. He's collected his semen is frozen, and it's going to be good in perpetuity. So he's grandfathered in as far as like being, once he's passed and no longer with us, he'll still be able to produce offspring for a very long time. You know, he'll be breeding, I don't know, people have different opinions of it. I believe that he'll probably stop actively breeding when he's 24, so, you know, he's got a few years left. But, you know, after that, he'll be breeding on frozen semen, and it's really, my job is to make sure that, you know, the babies are promoted in the best way possible, with the best trainers, with the best exhibitors. I have top non-pros that and he passes on the best traits to his offspring, and they just love him. And so making him, you know, furthering his you know, breeding career and his legacy is pretty much going to be what's on the table. And he's already done everything he needs to do in every other regard. He's hit a new milestone of 10 million. We just celebrated last December 7 million. So he did 3 million offspring earnings in less than 1 year, which, that's just crazy. So
that's very impressive.
Yes. And right now I'm trying to broaden the disciplines that he's involved with. So I've gotten involved with the Riata buckle for roping, and I do, I'm getting involved in other disciplines so that he can branch out and have offspring showing in more and more disciplines. Some stallions already have that. Some are just limited to this, that, and the other thing, but I'm trying to get it to where he can actually be doing, you know, more, and getting involved with that and supporting, you know, his customers and the competitions that they're trying. So there's a new program that just started with the Rain Cow Horse, and I plan to get involved with that. And I just bought my very first real cow horse, 2-year-old filly that's going to hopefully go to the Snaffle Bit next year, and I will be breeding her to him next year. So that's exciting. And then, you know, I have a very small breeding program. I just have a few mares, pretty much that's, I mean, the 5-10 year plan is just, it's always the same. You know, you're just continuously trying to expand across the globe, get the best mares, get the best clients and the best trainers and the best show people, and then watch it flourish. And he does amazing things, so it's been great.
I think it's really cool that you, I'm going to touch back on what you just said, the fact that you're kind of going to expand him into other disciplines, because I feel like, you know, the end consumer is a little more excited about that horse that can do a little bit of everything versus one that can only stick to one thing. So that's really cool that you're doing that. Is that why you decided to do that, or are you just doing it just to break the monotony?
No, it's not really monotonous, but So he's, you know, each, we've gotten in the horse industry over the years, over the past 5 decades that I've been doing it, you know, the horses have become so very specialized. Dressage horses do dressage, jumping horses do jumping, you know. But in the olden days when I was young, you know, we had all around. So you had a horse, yeah. Your parents got you a horse, and man, whatever you wanted to go do, whether it was pony club, you went and did everything. I've done a little bit of everything. I've taken my horses to the mountains, horse camping, even when like some of my high dollar jumping horses have gone fly fishing with me. So, you know, I think it's important to get back to the fact that, you know, these horses can do more than just the one specialized thing that sire did. And I think it's important to be able to show the athleticism and how it can be used to do more than just one thing. So we've specialized our horses and they're built a certain way to do certain jobs. But
yeah,
if you have a horse that's conformationally correct, that, you know, moves right and can do all the stuff, there's no reason why they can't do more than one thing or two or three things. So pretty much, you know, I have clients that, you know, I got involved with the Riata Buckle, and I have one client that's showing one of my offsprings, and he's so excited, and, you know, he just can't wait to show another one, and he's doing really well in the one he has, and he's a roping guy. So he was like, thank you for putting him in the Riata Buckle, and I was like, you're welcome, you know. So the more I find out about what's available and, you know, what I can be involved with, then the more I'm going to try to promote, like, let's see if we can't make one of these go do one of these things. So I have horses that are barrel racing, which, you know, you don't normally look at a reiner and say, oh, wow, that can make a barrel racer, but he did. So, yeah. You know, the cutting is a little bit harder. It's cutting horses are really, really specialized, and they've pretty much bred down to where they have to be, you know, a certain way. But
right.
There's no reason why, if you can find the right cross, that you can't make one. It might not, you know, it might not be the next, whatever, greatest, most important horse ever, but still the horses can do it. And the more you expand, the more availability you give to new people to come and try a sport. And that's, I guess, the whole point of it is, at some level, every baby should be able to go and do a job at some level somewhere.
Right.
I love the ranch riding. It's very difficult to do. Everyone thinks it looks so simple. It's very hard. There's a lot of strategy to it. And, you know, my horses are just gorgeous movers, and you have to be able to have that. So, okay, we're doing that as well. And then, you know, you branch out to doing this cow thing, and then you branch out to doing this trail thing. And so I just think there's just a lot of opportunity to make him available to more people that don't have to spend $100,000+ to buy a reining horse.
Yeah, I think I'm glad that you're touching on this, because, you know, it's very common to hear that people say, even I've said it, you know, well, this horse is bred to do this, and this horse is bred to do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I do feel like there is some truth in that. But you are correct with what you just said about how, you know, if a horse is conformationally correct and moves correct, like what you just said, they should be able to do most anything that you ask them to do. It might not be top tier, or that's the wrong word. It might not be like what people are accustomed to seeing for that discipline, but you are correct, because the last girl I had a episode with, she kind of touched base on the same kind of concept. You know, she was like, you know, I could take my Arabian bred horse into a cutting. Would it be ideal? Probably not. Would we do it? Yes. And she's right, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Arabs are a classic example. I mean, they are not designed the way they're built. They weren't bred for that. They're
right.
They're bred for endurance, so they're bred to go do the things that they do. That's why they're from the regions that they're from, and they were used for the purpose they were used for. However, there have been some pretty exceptional reining horses. And one thing, I bred a few half-Arabs, actually. So I crossed my stallion on some Arab mares and had some pretty cool half-Arabs that actually could go and, you know, do the job. So I think that people in general, like horse people in general, or people that are trying to get into the thing, they get advice, right? They'll find someone they trust, they get advice, and they go and buy a horse, but they're not, you know, there's no counseling on, hey, this is what I'd like to do and how I'd like to try it, and what do you think about this horse working? Because everybody gets myopic. They want to get focused on the one thing that they think works and stick with that. And I just so disagree. I just think that if you buy a properly built, well-balanced horse with a good mind and you want to go try something, yeah, maybe you're not going to win. Maybe you're not going to be the top horse in the whole wide world at that thing, but you can still right. go be successful and enjoy it and have fun doing it. When I breed my horse to some out crosses, then people are like, what are you doing? They think I'm nuts. And then the horse goes and it's super successful. And I thought, well, you know, sometimes I enjoy the experiment of it. Sometimes I want to see if something's going to work. I want to see how it's going to pan out. You can forever just keep doing the same thing, but when you try something new and different and it works, it's more rewarding. It's more fun.
Right.
And it also creates new audience. And it also creates new interest. So I do it a lot. I mean, I cross them on a lot of things and people are like, I don't know. And I'm like, well, we'll see, won't we? When the baby shows up, we're going to see what we got. And I just have a lot of fun doing that. I also have the ability to do it because, you know, I can. But I just think that that's like, I don't like where our industry is heading, where it's so focused, where you can just, it's just this on this on this on this. And it starts to become so, the horses are becoming so streamlined and so specialized that, you know, you can't even break the mold. You know, and I don't think that's healthy. I think the bigger the gene pool, the more interesting individuals you make, the different types, body types that you can create, I think that then you can really start to expand.
Now, you just made me think about something. What do you think, it's interesting that he's going in, or you've got him kind of going into roping really close to reining, because I think I saw a discussion about how the sliding stop, I mean, like, if you don't think about it, that stock can kind of go into other areas, and roping and team roping, calf roping, even breakaway, it's the first place that that horse would use that. And most people don't think about that.
Well, so I've actually never seen an actual roping yet. I'm planning to go and follow this kid that's riding mine. I want to see what he's doing. It's so fast. So he sent me a little video clip of the baby doing that, and I had to watch it 30 times just to, you know, figure out how do you possibly judge something going so fast. But I say the same thing about the barrel racing. The only difference between racing and things that are subjective is that, you know, because they're timed, right? So you have a clock and it stops and you either made it or you didn't. I find right. that completely interesting just in general with all of it. I mean, even, you know, in racing, you don't have questions, right? There's a clock there, so you just know. When it's subjective and you have to have it do, then, you're right. You get into, wow, you know, I mean, this horse, this stop could be valuable in this place or that place and facilitate this event or that event. And also, you know, there's all the genetics regarding, you know, speed or endurance. So, again, you know, Arabs are designed to go a really, really long time. And at speed, they can sprint. But they're designed to go for a very long time. They make great endurance horses. So then you're trying to figure out, you know, do we want in reining, do we want speed or do we want endurance? Well, we need a little bit of both, right? Because they have so many speed changes. The patterns are, you know, 3.5 minutes long. They're not 3, 4, or 5 seconds, right? You know, in the roping, right. It's like sprint, run out of the gate, grab that thing and stop and do all your stuff. And it's like, wow, how did you do that in 5 seconds? Like, I mean, wow. It all becomes, you know, a challenge as to like, okay, well, in order to be successful in roping, what do we need to do? What do we need to cross on to make the ideal roping horse? And so that's where this kid's like really interested in the breeding, and we've been talking a lot about that. He has one that's just been really successful. So I'm trying to figure out, well, that's kind of cool. I like it.
Well, I think it's because you just made me think about, like, isn't there a company out there that does the genetic testing? And one of the tests is, like, actual stride length and, like, how fast they can go or not go, or what would produce with X crawls. And to me, that just blows my mind that that technology is available. Like, it's just insane what you can, the whole genetics world, it's crazy what people, what you can do now.
Well, technology is certainly changing our industry significantly and very rapidly. Whether or not it ends up being a good thing, we don't know yet. It's because it's too early on. There's not enough full crops. I'm not a big fan of all of it. I'm a big fan of the testing that prevents, you know, compromised individuals and poor matings. But, you know, we just don't know yet. Like, you know, we have so much information and we're using it, which is great. It's fine. But, you know, you got to be a little bit careful about experimentation in some things that, you know, maybe should be left to a higher power. I'm not saying anything about that because I actually am part of a genetics company, but that's working on equine genetics. But you know, the information is valuable. It depends how you use it, depends what's going to happen, and also we just don't know yet where we're going as far as some of the technology that we're using. And it's going to be interesting to see. It's like AI. I mean, it's moving so fast that, you know, we're all just getting swung up in it, you know, and I think it's going to be fun to see how it pans out.
Well, I mean, you're right. Things like that, it's always a double-edged sword because it's like a really, really great thing. Really, really good things can come from it, but you also have that other side that just like, well, AI is a perfect example. Like, you know, you can't, it's hard to trust anything you see on the internet now just because of AI. But then again, it's a really great tool that's being used for great stuff. So I completely understand what you're saying.
I just think it's going to take, 10 years. Normally it does take 10 years. So just, in general, when you start breeding a stallion, generally it takes 10 years to figure out at the end of 10 years what the best cross is, what the magic cross is, as they call it, you know, what worked, what didn't work. You know, there's a lot of things that go into it. It's not just, oh, I'm going to make a bunch of babies and then he's going to be a stallion. Right. I mean, there's so many stallions out there. How many of them become famous or become important or big or this? Not all of them. It's not always their fault either. Maybe they didn't get the best mare access to them or something. So there's just so much that goes into the recipe of creating this thing that we're trying to do. But people have to be a little bit careful. I feel like the technology removes part of the game that really was interesting to me, which is that part of the game used to be, I have this boy horse, I've got this, you know, female horse, and I'm like, I just want to see if that's going to work, right? So, like, not having access to all the technology and dealing with the puzzle used to be part of what made it a little bit of a challenge and more fun. So now you can eliminate a lot of the guesswork because there are just some things that don't work that we know. And
right.
So I mean, a little bit it's tinkering, but I used to enjoy sort of the fun of that, like I said, the experiment, but we'll see because we just don't know yet. And just using technology, it's maybe not going to be 100% what we think it is. I don't know. We'll see. We'll find out.
That's like, I agree with what you said earlier. You know, sometimes it's fun to just say, okay, well, let's see what happens. And then, you know, it's just like that saying, you don't know the answer if you don't ask. The answer, well, no, that's the wrong way. The answer will always be no if you don't ever ask. So it's always kind of better to try and say you tried something versus not ever knowing.
And I really love using the technology to avoid the absolute worst case scenario. And we've gotten to the point where we can actually curtail a lot of the negative part and the deleterious part or the failed matings. And we've really gotten to a point where we can really, really avoid that. So to that extent, I'm all about it. But there's other parts of it that, you know, could potentially be a problem. For instance, you know, you can do sex selection. And just like in people, we've decided in people that this is not a good thing to do, right? I mean, you can do it, but if everybody decides to do it and you end up, you know, you have all tight ends and no wide receivers, you're going to have a problem. I mean, it's
right.
just the way it's going to go. The team has to be balanced. So, you know, certain things, not a fan, but, you know, everybody gets to make their own choice. That's what we have as options, but we'll see if that works out at the end of the day to have been something good for the whole entire breeding industry. I'm not sure. And, but I think that science is invaluable, and the ability to advance using science is very, very important, and something we don't want to ever lose having access to, you know.
Right.
We have to control some certain aspects of it, but, you know, I think in general people try to make good choices. It's just that sometimes you can get a little carried away, you know. It always
Well, yeah. And it's probably chalked up to a matter of morality and ethics. I mean, you know, just like in anything in life, most of those questionable things are going to be chalked up to something of that nature. And then that's where you have boards come in, and then you have things that can regulate stuff like that. So, because I'm sure there is going to be a matter of ethics involved with it, you know, what you can and can't do or should and shouldn't do. So,
yes, and we're still trying to feather that out. And then, like, as you mentioned, you know, we are a global presence, so then, you know, you can't always control things going on in some other part of the world where maybe they don't care as much as we do.
Right.
But again, you know what? Sometimes you have to let people do things that we don't agree with, because at the end of the day, they're not going to be successful because that thing won't work. It sounds good at the time, but maybe it doesn't work, right? And so we control what we control. We try to make rules to protect our animals the best that we can, and then we are guided by those principles, and then we let everybody else do what they're going to do. And then, you know, I mean, I just really believe that at the end of the day, you know, the right thing generally prevails. So
Yeah. No, I concur. Now, I also wanted to, before I forget, I wanted to ask you, did you grow up in a horse-related family at all? Did your parents and all that good stuff do horses, or were you the oddball?
So my father was in the military. He was in the Marine Corps when I was born, and my grandfather, my mother's father, raised horses, lived in upstate New York. Unfortunately, he passed away before I was born, but I believe that being a horse person is genetic as well, and so I think I inherited the horse gene from him. But nobody else in my family actually is into horses. No, well, my mother's sister actually rode horses, but she has since passed also. But she rode jumping horses. So yes, in my family, there was a background in farming, ranching, and raising horses. And my immediate family is not into horses.
I think, and this is always like run true, because the people that didn't necessarily grow up around it, like even if they had that urge and that love for it, even if they didn't grow up around it, they end up being the most educated and some of the most successful people in the industry versus those that were like born on a horse. And I don't know why that is. It just seems to be like a going thing. It's like, I don't know. It's so weird. I guess maybe the love just drives them further.
Yeah, I think when you have to pursue something that you want so badly that you tend to become more educated doing it, don't you agree?
Yeah.
And then, my father said to me not too long ago, he says, well, I guess the riding lessons paid off, which I thought that was so funny from him, because, you know, my family was, didn't have a lot of means, and I had to work very, very hard to pay for my lessons and to earn them. I had to work for my riding lessons, and you know, I was just a little girl, and ever since I can remember, you know, coming home from nursery school, there was where I would go after school, and there was a little black Arab across the fence. I'm pretty sure if I saw her today, I wouldn't even believe it. But at the time when I was, you know, 5, 6, 7, I was she's the most beautiful thing in the whole wide world. And I just would stare at her the whole time I was there, literally every day. And when I got to ride my first horse, it was, you know, I mean, it was probably the best day that I ever had in my childhood. So it's just kind of funny for my father to say that. I really thought that was kind of cool. And
That is cute because, you know, it, like you kind of touched on it a little bit, you know, the industry, it's easy to get caught up into the business aspect of the industry, which it is. It's a business, you know. Yeah. You have to run it that way if you want to be successful at it. But to not lose that, like, love for the animal, you know. And I think it's cool to speak to somebody, you know, like yourself, who's got this really successful stallion in, you know, a pretty predominant part of the industry that still kind of has that little girl love for it, like we all had. You know, we all had that childlike giddiness about the horse. And, you know, it's easy to lose that if you don't keep it at heart.
You know, I've had I can say that I've had a very blessed life. And how many people in the world can say that they were able to make a living doing the thing that they were most passionate about and loved so much? And I could never trade. I mean, it wasn't always easy, right? It's a lot of work. It's hard. It was, you know, you're a young person. You're trying to, you know, whatever it is, pay rent, pay a car payment, whatever. You're, you know, training horses back then in the day when I was training them was, you know, you weren't going to be a millionaire. But the point is, you know, I just always wanted to be around the horses, and I had a fabulous clientele and a great career. I really am so lucky that I could really make life work and do what I wanted to do. And, you know, over time, it wasn't intentional to have my stallion. I never thought in a million years that I'd be sitting here having this conversation with you, thinking about what he's brought to me and what I've done with him. And it was just, he is the culmination of 40 years of absolutely dedication and hard work and wanting to always improve on what I had or to do better or to find a better way. And you know, I am truly, truly very blessed and lucky. I mean, I can't imagine that it could happen twice, and I never thought it would happen to me. I mean, never thought I would be in this spot, but, you know, right. It's amazing, and I'm truly grateful. I mean, really.
That's sweet. I think that's awesome, and he's gorgeous, too, and you just made me think about something. Have you ever actually shown him, or have you just preferred somebody, not that you couldn't, but have you just preferred somebody else to ride him? Have you ever rode him?
Well, I rode him when he was two. He's not a toy. So once it became clear that he was going to be, you know, an actual viable, you know, open horse, which again, I didn't grow up in the reining or the Western, so I didn't really know what I was getting into. But once it became clear that, you know, this was a really, there was something super special about this, you know, playful, flirty little blue-eyed, white eyelash little pony, I was like, you know, then, you know, I didn't feel the need where it was, I didn't purchase him for me to have as a non-pro horse to go out and be a little monkey on his back. So once he became, you know, once he won the futurity, it was just, I've ridden him. I mean, I got on him after the run for a million in my gown and my heels. I mean, I'm not, like, I could go ride him anytime I wanted to, but I respect him enough that he's not a toy. And so, you know, I play with him. I connect with him. He's, when we're together, you can tell that he knows who I am. I know who he is. And, you know, I mean, I just love him, but really, honestly, it's not, I have plenty of other ones to play with. So he's not the one that I, you know, that I show.
Well, that's what I kind of thought. Like, it's not, you know, it's not a reflection of, you know, skill or anything of that matter. I was just asking because a lot of people don't even have time to do it. If they have X amount of horses, it just makes more economical sense to have somebody else do it, not that they can't. So that's probably what I figured.
You know, in the reining, it's different, right? Because, I mean, these are open horses. He only showed six times. So he did all of his accomplishments in six major events, and that's it. And so if you think about that, I gave him an entire year off. So he showed as a 3-, 4-, 5-, and 7-year-old, and that was it. And then he came back and showed at 17, right? And by managing him the way that I did manage him, his legs are completely clean. He's sound. He passed the jog on the first try. He is in as great a shape as he could possibly be in, and he will be until the day he passes. I mean, I'm meticulous about his care, but I have nine of his daughters sitting in my yard here. So I've got baby horses and pregnant mares and yearlings. And, you know, if I want to go ride something, it's not, I have 12 total horses right now, but just one colt and all the rest are daughters. But, you know, I'm pretty much working on phase two, which is now promoting his daughters and getting him ready. And a couple of his sons are standing at stud. So, you know, seeing what they're going to do. And it's important that he can make sons. It's important he can make daughters. It's important he can have geldings that are, it's almost across the board, a third, a third, a third, where, you know, it doesn't matter what you get. So not every stud is like that either. Some only make boy horses, some only make mares, you know, and so it's interesting to be in this phase where now I'm just kind of seeing, you know, I'm managing the legacy is what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's funny you say that, because I have noticed other stallions, not necessarily just in reining, in the discipline of reining, but across the board, some people do show the hell out of them. They show them constantly, 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 because I guess maybe they feel like that's the only way to get them marketed in the aspect of their accomplishments. And so it's kind of cool that you were able to get what he needed as far as his accomplishments in a matter of six, because some people do. You see them show them all the time.
Okay, but for me, money was not the point. So I never did any of this for money, mostly because, one, I didn't know anything about it, and two, it wasn't, back then, the kind of money that's available now wasn't available back then anyway. But I have other businesses. I mean, he's a part of who I am, and he's a very big important part of my life, obviously, but he's not how I make a living, and I wasn't going to use him up. Putting money earnings on him isn't going to change how elegant and beautiful he is and what product he puts on the ground. So, you know, using him up and to the point that, you know, he can't walk, that was never going to be an option for me. And if you only do things for money, well, we have names for people like that. And, you know, that's just not what I'm about at all.
And
for any of them. And I don't show any horse that isn't ready. So if it's not trained up and ready,
Well, hold on. I'm confused now, because I thought people did that. I'm genuinely confused. I thought people did it to get their accomplishments on the board. Because let's say I'm a customer and I'm shopping for a stallion. Well, am I going to invest in a stallion that hasn't accomplished anything, or a stallion that has accomplished anything? So I thought they were doing it for like a resume perspective.
Okay,
is that normally why people do it?
Sure, but if you have the top resume and you only showed six times, do you need the top resume but you had to show 26 times, and then also you're crippled? So you're the prospective person looking for a stallion, right? And then here's my stallion. He goes out, he wins the futurity, then he triple crowns. Then he goes to France, he wins two gold medals, and that's six shows. And by the way, he's won everything. No one can ever do what he's done, because now at the World Equestrian Games, they no longer allow reining. That's a whole other podcast. But anyway, you know, so here's the top stallion in the world who's producing the most amazing horses. And do you need to go to the stallion that can't walk, who had to show 26 times to get an equivalent resume? No, you don't. You're going to take the CEO that has proven himself, and done the best job and is in the best shape. That's what you're going to do. So when people look
I absolutely agree with you. I just didn't understand.
That's the problem with the industry, right? So if you're only focused on money, if you're only focused on getting money earnings, the only reason why they're going to show 26 times is because they want to have, my horse has the most earnings. Well, you can't even look at it like that anymore. You can't look at it like that. Yeah, you can, but you can't look at it anymore, because when my horse showed, there was you know, the money pots were small. And so, and horses before him, they were even smaller. So the money has grown over time. So yeah, does it sound good to say, oh, I have $1 million in earnings? Okay, that's fine. You know, you showed 26 times. My horse has $350,000 in earnings. He only showed 6 times. He won everything. So
I see what you're saying now.
What he was showing, he was undefeated. Yeah. So he, you know, and then, you know, when you're the prospective owner, obviously, there's 1 million stallions out there. This is the problem. We actually have too many stallions in our industry, I think. And
I agree. I concur. Well,
yes. And so it's then you have to just say, well, you want the horse that you know produces the offspring that do what you want to do. That's who you're going to breed to. So that's why when I say I want to expand my horizons to where he can go across multiple disciplines, maybe you're not a reiner, maybe you're not a cutter, maybe you're not a cow horse, maybe you want to go do this, you know, kind of ranch riding or trail or whatever it is, sport that you decide that you want to do, then, you know, I want to make one. Okay, how do we make one? Well, that's what we're doing now. That's what I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to figure out, how do I make one that could go do that? Because that person wants to go do that, like the roping kid. He's like, he wants to have, you know, he has one. He loves it, and he wants another one. He's told me, he goes, I want to ride for you. He wants to come out and try to find another one somewhere where he can ride for me. So I think that that's totally interesting to me and cool. And so I want to help him in that endeavor. So my goal now is to encourage people, what do you want to try? How do we make one?
Yeah. I thought you meant like actual profit off of the horse money. And I was like, well, if they're not making any profit, if they're showing all the time, but I get what you're saying. It's what their earnings are. And you are right. I mean, that's just going to be a matter of math. You know, if this horse earned $300,000 with one show versus this horse that earned $300,000 at 20 shows, well, that's going to speak for itself. So thank you for clarifying that, because I was kind of like confused, because I don't know anything about it. You know more about it than I do. As far as the roping is concerned, you said you haven't been to one yet, right?
I have what? I'm sorry, you cut out.
You haven't been to a roping yet, or you have?
I have not been to a roping yet, but I am planning to. I'm going to Snafflebit Security this weekend, and the kid I've been speaking about, he lives down in Weatherford, so I'm planning to figure out how to go and start to see some of these different kinds of events. So,
how cool is that? It's going to be fun.
It's going to be amazing. And actually, one in the very beginning, when I first started breeding my stallion, one of the top breeders is one of the top roping guys in history, and he, Bobby Lewis, and he bred his best mares to baby and made some incredible horses. And but I never got to see Bobby roping. So, you know, I've had opportunities, but, you know, I'm just really busy, so you can't see everything all the time. And then when I was showing, I didn't have the opportunity. Plus, I moved from California to Texas and during COVID, so there's just been a little bit of a delay in being able to get out and see everything. But I'm starting to get to the point where I can actually expand and check it out. I'm excited. It's fun.
I think that's really exciting. If I were you, I would be really excited about it because, and you sound like you are, because it's just cool to hear of this reigning guy, I mean, stud, that has just, his resume crazy good, is going to cross over into roping. You know, you don't hear that a lot, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and this kid's doing amazing. Like, he went to a big futurity, and his horse marked a huge score. I'm, and it's not that I'm shocked, it's just I didn't know about it, right? So
yeah,
it's fun. Here's the fun part. Someone I don't know is contacting me to let me know they have one and how excited they are. Like, how can it get any more fun than that? Because I'm like, I'm just a grandma now, right? I'm like, let me go see my baby and my grandchild, you know, and it's just really cool. And it happens a lot now. So there's lots of people doing different things. I have one gal that was on the cover of a magazine, and she has put the first rein cow horse earnings on him. And I just think it's so exciting for her, and she's so proud of that because she is the first trained cow horse earnings on him, and she gets to, you know, be acknowledged for that. And that's one of my most fun things too, is sharing the experience with the people that are riding them. My horse has introduced me to some just amazing people of all levels, all across the world, all different kinds of people.
I figured it out, actually, yes. Was from him. That's how I found you, was through him, and I happened to see it through a sponsorship that you guys did, and I was like, hold on a second, and then you end up putting like two and three together. You're like, I'm friends with her. Are you serious?
You know, I always say that, you know, he's my secretariat story, and, you know, I'm Penny Chenoweth. Sometimes I feel that way with him. It's like he's just that special, and sometimes I have to pinch my own self. It's like, I can't believe that, you know, I never set out to do this, you know what I mean? It happened to me, and he happened to me, and, you know, God brought him to me for whatever reason and put me in charge of him, and I take that responsibility very, very seriously. But I am, you know, I'm just so blessed beyond measure to own him, to have had a chance to have him. And it was so random a thing. It was like, it's just fate, right? You think, how did this possibly happen to a little girl from California that really, you look at all the people that have been involved in reining, all this time, and people would say, I've been trying for 30 years to win the futurity. And I would make jokes. I was like, well, you might want to try something else, because it really wasn't that hard, you know. And I just make it as a little silly, because I'm like, well, I just went out and here's this guy, you know, he just happened to be for sale, and it's just crazy, right? I mean, what are the chances that I would fly from Vegas to Texas to go in a little place, it's this little stable, little barn, and find this cute as a buggy horse, just, you know, and he was waiting for me because I actually came to try two horses, him and a half-brother, and the other one was, you know, full-bodied and much more my style of horse. It looked more like a little miniature warm blood and just, you know, pretty.
Oh, really?
and solid bay, no white whatsoever. And I had never seen a horse with all that white all over its face, blue eyes and little white eyelashes. And here's a little baby, and he's on the wall, and he's watching me, and he's flirting, and he really does flirt. If you get a chance to meet him, you should go there. You should just go and hug him. He is a flirt, and he was so funny, and he would not stop trying to get my attention. So when I rode him, and he just unbelievable how he just felt so incredible for me. From my experience as an English rider, he was just the most gorgeous mover, and I don't know, it just happened. I went home, and I hadn't decided which one I wanted, and I called him up, and I'm like, I'll take that one. And who would have guessed? I mean, who would ever have guessed that I'd just be sitting there in my little house in California, and here I have this amazing animal now today. It's just, and I'm sitting here staring at my trophy room. I'm looking at the history of all of it from day one, like literally, driving home with that, you know, Futurity Champion trophy on my dashboard of my RV. And I'm like, wow, this is just crazy that happen to me, you know?
Right, and just to think, like, it could have went a completely different way. Like, it's always, like, you just sat there and said, you went to go see one, and here he is, and for some reason you chose him. Like, it's just wild that stuff like that kind of, it is, it's got to be fate. I mean, there's just no other thing to kind of chalk stuff like that up to.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because at the time that I got into it, it's almost like, things just fell into place for that horse. They always have. So no matter what it was, whether it was rider changes or just different things, he always comes through the winner. And he always comes through and it works in his favor. And I mean, I just don't think that always happens. Do you know what I mean? I think that just doesn't always happen.
Well, he's already made a massive impact in the industry. I mean,
yeah,
you know, so I feel like you guys have already accomplished that. So,
well, I'm telling you, the Run for Million was pretty exceptional. I'll tell you why. I mean, I don't know how many horses get a standing ovation, but he got one on the way into the pen, and he got one on the way out, and I was so proud of him. It was just incredible. And Sean Flaherty is just an amazing, amazing man, amazing family person, husband, you know, father, grandfather. He just loves my horse. The text that he would send me when I sent the horse to him, he's like, I just didn't know how much I missed him. And it's like having my old friend back. And I mean, these things are endearing, and you can never, you know what I mean? Like you can't make it up. It's just part of the whole journey with him.
Well,
with Spooko is.
I think it's amazing, and I applaud you and congratulate you for what you guys have done and what he's done as a horse. I think it's awesome, and I'm glad that you took the time to chat with me about it, because it's really interesting to, like what you just said, you moved from California to Texas, you know. Are you originally from California?
I sure am. I was born and raised.
And then you said, screw it, I'm going to Texas.
58 years. Well, I mean, that's a whole nother podcast, but I mean, I wanted to be out here with him, and I missed a lot of his, you know, formative growing years, because I wasn't here, I was there, and I could only get out here 3 times a year. But I had a big ranch there, and you know, as things go, it's not simple just to, you know, just decide to move, to sell real estate and to move your whole, you know, livelihood. I lived there my whole entire life. 58 years is a long time. So, and I never lived more than 30 miles from Camp Pendleton. So it was a lot for me to move out here, but I moved here and I was only 15 minutes away from him. And it was quite awesome to be able to just pop in the car and hop on over there. but now he's in Weatherford, so he's about an hour and a half away, but still, at least I'm in the same state as he is, but yeah.
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal. You are right. It is not a jump in the park or walk in the park to move horses. I'm assuming horses, you had horses there if you had a ranch, you know, to move all of that. How many states, I mean, how long of a drive is it from California to Texas? It's got to be over 12 hours.
It's 24 hours. It's actually a 2-day trip. And, no, I had 100
Holy
horses,
cow.
But we had horse shows at my facility. So it was, you know, it was not going to be simple to move 100 horses and to, you know, do all that. As it went with COVID, COVID changed everything. And so actually, because of COVID, it made it easier to get out here than it probably otherwise would have. And that's, you know, I mean, I'm here. So I'm very happy to be in Texas and very happy to be, you know, around my clients and be able to go. It's a lot easier from here to go either one direction or the other, from one coast to the other. So,
yeah, I've got customers in California, and it's not to say the horse industry isn't lit in California. California's got a lot of horse people in there, you know, but you are right, for reining, it tends to be an Oklahoma-Texas thing. It's where, like, that's like the heart of reining.
Yeah, I mean, most of my clients are out
and
here. Yeah. Well, I mean, so California used to be, I think, pretty much used to be central for the rain cow horse and for a lot of the reining, but I'm not really sure exactly when that changed, but it's very expensive to have horses in California, so it made sense for what the business out here, because this is centrally located. You could go anywhere with a 15-hour drive, so it's a lot different. Imagine trying to go from California to a horse show in Florida. I mean, that's hard, right? But from Texas, not hard. I was concerned about, you know, things that didn't actually pan out to be a problem, like weather. So the weather here is really not difficult to deal with. But it's when you live in California, it's always 74. So, okay. Gets a little windy, gets a little cold, gets a little hot. It's not that big a deal. But funny, because it was a thing.
Right.
Now it's not a thing. But
I would have felt this. I would have felt the same thing. Now that you just said that, if I was just walking down the street and ran across you, I'd be like, yeah, I bet you California's weather has no problems, and Texas probably does have problems. So it's crazy that you said that it's the opposite.
I will tell you, though, you know, in Texas, we don't have wildfires, but in California, we don't have tornadoes, right? Every geographic location has its set of problems, but the cost is the cost is so significant to raise horses in California that it's just gotten to the point where it's very difficult to do. I have, actually, and I had 100 horses on my ranch, so it wasn't like I had three, you know.
Jesus Christ. I
mean, yeah.
That's a lot of horses.
It is a lot of horses, but when you have a cute stallion, you tend to have a lot of horses.
Yeah. So do you, well, wait, you just made me think about this. So do you miss, like, operating that type of operation or managing that type of operation and having that many, you know, were they obviously all weren't your personal horses, you know, what did you do to have 100 horses on a ranch like that?
No, actually they were, but they were my horses, but we had horse shows there, and so I developed the ranch over 15 years, and I had a lot invested in it, and yes, I miss some aspects of it. I don't miss having to be home at 7 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon every single day and not being able to go anywhere. So I enjoyed the few years that I didn't have horses here at my property. I enjoyed having a little bit more freedom. But now I've only got, I think I have 8 or 9 here, and I've got 3 that are out in training. So it's that's all I have, and him. He's at the breeding farm. But I'm breeding just 2 or 3 a year now, so it's a lot better.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's a lot of stress.
And, you know, a lot less expense and manage and just dealing with things. And, hey,
well,
I'm slowing down.
So. Yeah. I mean, I have a customer of mine. She owns her and her partner own a business, and they had a couple of locations, and they had like 75 employees or a lot of employees. And she said, you know, at a certain point, it's not a matter of you can't do it. It's a matter of, you know, you're tired. I mean, you're not going to stay. We're all going to die at some point. So you're not going to stay, you know, a prime age where that's what you're going to do 24/7. So, you know, it makes sense for somebody to want to calm down a little bit, not have to deal with so much at once, because I couldn't imagine having to deal with 100 horses. Like, that would be – I'd need a couple of employees to handle all of that.
I had quite a few employees, but
– Yeah.
You know, you have to understand, like, 100 horses sounds like a lot, but, you know, if you have 10 or 15 brood mares, you have 10 or 15 babies every year, and – you know, think about that. So,
right.
They're pregnant. They have weanlings. You have, you know, yearlings. You have 2-year-olds. Some are getting sold. Some are getting shown. I mean, it's not like, so it's multiple years where to the point where you get to that 100. It's not like you just said, well, I'm just going to have 100 horses. It kind of happens to you because breeding is so fun. So I just love watching the babies pop out until I have to start feeding them. And then I'm like, oh, my God, what have I done? You know, and and, you know, they're show horses. So I had, you know, 3 or 4 that I was showing and 3 or 4 that my trainer was showing. So, you know, it was just a mix. But we had a reigning affiliate that used my facility, and we had horse shows there, and it was just a lot of fun. And so there was just a lot of activity going on. And, yes, I had probably, I don't know, there was at least 10 people lived on the ranch that took care of everything. So it wasn't like, you know what I mean? That wasn't hard. It's a lifestyle. So same as ranchers, you know, that have 400 horses, you know, you have a big ranch, you got 400 horses, you got people and you take care of them. And that's kind of how it goes. I mean, I didn't even think about it really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, it sounds like it was just a way of life for you, which is still kind of cool.
Yeah. And now I'm getting back to that, because now I just brought all these horses to my property, and now I'm taking care of them again. They're beautiful, and I love them. And, you know, it's nice to be able to go out and just give one a hug or, you know, take a walk. And I don't have a big property here, but it's big enough. It's 20 acres, and it's very pretty. And so, you know, but, yeah, I like to be able to – I'm going overseas a lot now to go watch horse shows, and I like to be able to go and visit with my clients and to attend horse shows. And I have a couple that are showing still with open trainers, and, you know, it's good.
Well, it sounds like you are where you should be.
Yes.
kind of like the whole fate of having baby, you know. It was fate for you to end up in Texas and do what you do. So it's really cool, and I'm very happy for you, and I'm super excited that you took the time to talk to me about all of this, because I think it's really cool. I think a lot of people, they just see a stallion or they just see a horse, and they don't even think anything past that and what actually goes into it and what you guys have to deal with and how it comes about. And so it's really cool that you took a second to talk to me about your story. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's awesome that you're, you know, introducing this to people, because then, you know, that's the only way that people can learn about it is to get educated and to hear these, you know, conversations. So thank you.
Yeah, because I didn't grow up around, I knew reining existed, but, and I've always kind of watched it from afar and just kind of like gazed at it, because I just always thought it was, the whole slide is just magnificent to me. I just think it's just the coolest thing in the world. And like, even like what me and Billy Smith talked about, or he actually made it a point in my head that, you know, the horse industry is, we're not used to having fans, and we kind of need fans in order to grow the industry and have it be treated as a sport, because a lot of it is a sport, you know. And so it's cool. It's cool to, for me to be a fan and kind of just like, I don't know. I just think it's cool to be a fan and like it and look at it and watch you guys do what you do. I just, you know, it's cool as hell.
Well, I think it's important, too, because we're at a point where the sport actually, you know, we need it to grow, and we need to, like you said, have, you know, much more visibility. Billy's awesome. I worked with him for many years when he was at APHA, and he's really got an excellent perspective on how to make it more attractive and more appealing to people that don't think they have a way to get involved. And so
right.
he's just started with NRHA not too long ago. I guess this might be his second year, but, you know, we'll see where he takes us. He's doing a great job.
Well, I think it's important to under, because he's very correct, and I've kind of thought this even from me, little old me. We insulate ourselves as the horse industry. He's very right. We have a tendency to do that because, you know, it's hard to take horses. A horse is just not a basketball. It's not a softball. It's not a football. It's not. You're not going to make it that. There's always going to be some type of emotional attack. Like you said it yourself, it's your baby. So
yeah.
There's always going to be an emotional attachment to something in a sport. So it's going to be hard to have the general public look at it as a sport, even though we tag on that line. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's hard to grow it when, just like what he said, like rodeo, you know, is a good example. The way those bulls are literally athletes, you know, and those bronc horses are literally athletes. Like, those horses are worth millions. And,
yeah.
You know, you have people come in and fans, they love the rodeo, but you also have that backlash of, well, you treat them bad and blah, blah, blah. Nobody says that about a football. Nobody says you treated that bat bad, or you hit that softball. You didn't give that softball therapy or whatever, you know. So it's because we're working with a living, breathing animal. So it's hard to kind of get to that hump.
Well, and, you know, it's just trying to get people to embrace it and to see it and to not feel like they don't, for people to get educated so they understand it, it brings them closer to it. And I think that will help a lot. So showing them that, and that was another reason why I sent my horse to Run for a Million at 17 years old, pulled him out of the thing he had been ridden in 10 years and said, hey, my horse can still go do this, because I really wanted people to see that there is, that he does have a life. So, yes, he's a breeding stallion. Yes, he's extremely valuable. And, yes, it was fun to go. And I had the best time ever. And the crowd loved him and gave him a standing ovation because they have that much appreciation for him. But imagine every little girl that was sitting in that audience that was like, oh, my gosh, Daddy, I just have to have a riding lesson. And maybe one of those little girls will grow up to be me someday, right? Because
right.
That's how I got started, right? I mean, sitting there at my nursery school, staring at the little bear across the on the other side of the chain link fence, I'm like, oh, I just loved her so much. She was so beautiful, right? And so I grew up, and I was like, this was just, I mean, literally, like, what I wanted to do. So, yeah, I mean, let's hope that that's the case, right? So we inspire people. We show them. We introduce them to things. You're doing your sharing stories, and I think it's important for people to understand all these sides of the story. So the rider's side, you know, Billy's take, you know, the stallion owner's perspectives, it's all good. All the things you're doing with these stories are important to share with people that don't actually have access to it, but could.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you're right. Like, I think it's cool that, you know, you've got people out there who are, you know, people out there that are, you know, a fan of it and get excited about it. Because you're right. We got to keep that in mind. So I really think it's cool that you took the time to talk to me about this.
Are you going to be at Futurity?
No. No, I don't ever go to any of them. I would like to go. I think I should go. It'd be cool to just kind of like meet certain people, because I've sponsored a couple of buckles, but I not ever went to any of them. So I need to go.
No, but you should think about going. You could meet Billy, and I could meet you there, and you could do some in-person interviews and kind of talk to some more people. And I don't know. I think it'd be pretty cool for you to do that.
Yeah, I think so, too, because you're not the only person that's kind of suggested that, because I do mainly embroidery and apparel and engraving, so it's been hard to actually leave to go to the shows, because I'm kind of a big stickler about getting my orders done on time and that kind of stuff, and I always thought it was kind of weird if my customers saw me at a show when I was supposed to be working. I always thought that was weird, so I didn't want to disrespect anybody, but somebody brought it up to me. They were like, you know, you should still maybe try to just go. And it's nice. It's just nice to have like a conversation or an in-person exchange with somebody versus just messaging or just email or whatever have you, even like these episodes on a podcast. It's just cool to like just meet people and get out there and say, hey, and that kind of stuff. So I've thought about it. I may do it.
Well, just go for the finals. You'd enjoy it. Yeah, I think you'd have a lot of fun. And meeting Billy, you'd enjoy meeting him in person. He's awesome.
He was so nice. He was so nice to me, because I've not been treated the best by certain people in the reining industry. And
really?
That's what I'm getting at. And so when Christy actually, I just randomly asked her on a whim. I didn't even think she would respond to me, but I love her. She's a very nice human being. She responded. I asked her, I was like, do you ever do podcasts? Would you ever want to just chat with me for a minute, you know, like, or do you know somebody that would? And she was like, I don't, but Billy will. And I was like, who? And she goes, because again, I'm a clueless reining person. I don't know anything about reining, right?
Yeah.
So she's like, Billy would. And she tells me who he is and all this kind of stuff. And this dude took the time to chat with little old me, this nobody, I don't even ride reiners. I don't even go to shows. And the fact that he just took the time to chat with me, answer my questions, and do all this stuff, I will always have much respect for him and Christy, because I just think that's so cool. It just makes you, when you take the time to do that with people that are outside of a clique per se, because you know the horse industry can be very clicky.
Yeah.
And when you take the time to do that and kind of be that nicer person, it leaves a better impression for people, the next generation, the next show, or the next person. And I just love that. I just think it was really cool. He was just a really, really nice guy. Sat there and talked to me for like an hour. It was so cool.
Well, Christy is fabulous, and I agree with you. And I think you should, if you get a chance. I would love to meet you, and Billy would too, and Christy's awesome, and you know, it'd be great. It would give you a different perspective to be there in person and to experience people, and certainly, you know, all of us could introduce you to other people that would be interesting for your stories, and it's just different aspects of it, right? So riders, trainers, all those different people that, you know, we'd get you with some good ones, like, you know, just people that are just really interested in having an impact or having, you know, opportunity to talk about it and coming from different angles.